This is the 20th year in the life of the United Nations. It's being observed throughout the world as International Cooperation Year, in the belief that greater awareness of the achievements of cooperation, rather than a preoccupation with conflict, will strengthen the cause of peace and human welfare. As a contribution to this objective, United Nations Radio is presenting a series of special programs on the extent and nature of cooperation through international organizations. In this program, the speaker is Alexander Scorby.
You'll recall the story, I'm sure, about that remarkable mathematician Archimedes, who took a bath some 2,200 years ago and thereby cleared up the question of specific gravity. When his body displaced some water on the floor, you remember, he suddenly jumped out of the tub shouting, "Eureka! I've found it!" It probably wasn't a very elegant spectacle. And I'm only bringing up the episode here because it seems to me that his shout was not just a shout of personal triumph in solving a problem that had been bothering him. It was just as much a clearly audible desire to communicate, to let others know what he'd found. He was, in other words, reacting as scientists traditionally do, cooperatively. These days, the cooperative tradition in science is not only a very lively one, it is assuming new proportions. It is, in fact, an expanding tradition. And it's the subject of this program. And when did the expansion get underway? If we go back 20 years, we find the tradition in pretty bad shape. The demands of wartime secrecy had split the world scientific community into isolated groups in different parts of the world. But the men and women in that community continued to yearn privately for the day when they would be free to work together again. Then came the event which placed the scientist squarely in the center of world affairs, the explosion of the first atomic bomb in the desert of New Mexico. That was in June 1945. 4 months later, the United Nations as an organization was in business, and a new partnership, unlike any before it, began to form. To describe it, let me play part of a speech given last year by the Secretary General of the United Nations.
Statesmanship and science join hands in the United Nations, not only in seeking to prevent war, and in redirecting human energies towards peaceful pursuits in general. They must, and they do, join to in the positive task of building a world in which the growing needs of all countries may be met through constructive and cooperative endeavors.
U Thant made that speech last August at the opening of the third UN conference on the peaceful uses of atomic energy. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend it, but I was at its two predecessors in Geneva in 1955 and 1958. Even 10 years after the war, the scientists' yearning for a return to free association, to full cooperation, had by no means been completely satisfied. The new and potentially catastrophic science of nuclear physics had developed during that decade in a very few secret pockets. Then there was that first UN Atoms for Peace conference in 1955. The atmosphere in the marbled halls and meeting rooms at the Geneva Palace of Nations was unlike anything I'd ever experienced in the often tedious business of conference watching. The hundreds of scientists and engineers who were there, and I hope they won't mind me saying it, were rather like schoolboys back at school on the first day of term, all eagerly and delightedly exchanging their vacation time experiences. And out of this exchange, something very interesting emerged. Despite the fact that they'd been obliged to work in isolation, they had, they discovered, all pursued their researches and experiments along almost identical lines and had all reached more or less the same stage of development. So much for the value of secrecy. The president of that conference was the Indian scientist Homi Bhabha. In his closing address, he said something which has, I'm afraid, been quoted in a lot of UN programs, but I make no excuses for reviving it here. Here, from the archives, it is.
Knowledge once given cannot be taken back. And in organizing this conference, the nations of the world have taken an irreversible step forward, a step from which there is no retreat.
At the third conference last year, it was clear that there had been no retreat. The main theme of the meeting was the development of nuclear energy as a source of power for economic development. And the advances in technology indicated that this is now emerging rapidly from dreamland into the realms of practical economic application. Cooperation, in short, is reducing costs. And that reminds me of another nuclear story in which it is helping to solve a problem of rising costs. During the last 20 years, research in high-energy physics has been getting more and more expensive. Some people tend to be reticent when they need more money, but not physicists. To work, they need machines, the vast accelerators hurling billions of electron volts at the secrets of nature. These magnetic monsters now cost hundreds of millions of dollars and pounds and francs and rubles. And as the experimenters predict their future needs, it begins to look as if their researchers could well become too costly for even the richest nations. The answer to this dilemma is, of course, obvious and has already been given. Since its beginning in 1946, the Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization of the UN, UNESCO, has been active in promoting and helping scientific cooperation in many areas. In 1950, it was asked by the UN Economic and Social Council to explore the possibilities for joint international research in the natural sciences. One of the results was the establishment of CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research. Situated on 100 acres of Swiss land on the French frontier near Geneva, CERN was recently leased another 100 acres on the French side of the line, thus making it the only international organization that actually occupies territory in two states. Costing about $25 million a year to run, the money coming from 13 European governments, CERN is a center for pure research. Over 1,600 people work there all the time. They come from many parts of the world and form a fellowship that is blissfully unimpeded by the strident conflicts that may divide their respective lands. Well, I'd like to stay in these circles a bit longer because CERN isn't the only example of its kind. And I don't want to give the impression that in order to inspire cooperation, you've got to be a physicist engaged in what is sometimes called big science. Big technology is inspiring it too, in the exploration of outer space. And out of the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space and its technical and legal subcommittees comes enough evidence of cooperative progress to suggest that we're going to avoid the cutthroat banditry that was so often characteristic of man's earlier adventures into the unknown. And then there's the big challenge, which is steadily becoming the greatest inspiration of all. This is the worldwide cooperative assault on poverty, in which, as Uthant observed just now, statesmanship and science join hands. At this point, I'd like to introduce two brief remarks by two men of science whose careers clearly demonstrate their awareness of the need for this partnership. And they're certainly not the only ones. Here's the first.
We're not looking for scientific miracles. Quite definitely, one isn't looking for miracles.
Sir Norman Wright, Secretary of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, a former Deputy Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, and at various times an advisor on food production problems to several governments in Asia and the Middle East.
I believe between now and the end of this century, if we applied existing knowledge in all countries of the world, we could produce enough food to feed even the far larger population we shall have at the end of the century.
The second man is Professor Eni Njoku, a Nigerian biologist and botanist who was vice-chancellor of the University of Lagos and who has also served his country as Minister for Mines and Power. Though he speaks of the situation in Nigeria, His counterparts in all the developing countries would undoubtedly say the same thing.
Our main problem is that the fundamental knowledge required is lacking. You want knowledge about the soil conditions, the atmospheric conditions. You want to know about the water resources. These fields, like agriculture and production, are not fields where you can easily transfer technology. In this field, our greatest crying need is more collection of information and data, which will enable us to adapt existing technologies and to know just where and how best we can exploit our own natural resources.
There are no doubt many reasons, political, historic, cultural, and economic, for the fact that even today most of the world's peoples have hardly reaped any of the benefits of science and technology, not to mention such superfluous refinements as an electric toothbrush. And it's only recently that statesmen and scientists have begun to realize that something can be done to change this old and dismal picture, provided there is the will to get together on the job. And 2 years ago, a conference clearly demonstrated that the will does exist. This was the UN conference on the application of science and technology for the benefit of the less developed areas. With a title like that, it's no wonder that everybody quickly called it UNSAT for short. For scope and size, Geneva had never experienced anything quite like that meeting before, and I won't even attempt to outline its agenda. Not because it isn't interesting, but because after any meeting, it's the follow-up that matters. And after UNSAT, the follow-up was more precisely defined than usual. Let me refer to just one feature of this follow-up. Sir Norman Wright and Professor Njoku are two of the 18 members of the UN Advisory Committee on the Application of Science and Technology to Development. Though they are only advisors, their recommendations can and indeed already have influenced the way ahead. There being no shortage of specific problems, the committee has examined a number which could be given priority consideration and be subjected to an attack in the grand manner. Water resources, for example, and the chances of taking the salt out of seawater economically. Or energy resources. Or control of the tsetse fly, which plagues nearly 4 million square miles of the African continent. Whatever method of control is adopted, whether by insecticides or biological techniques, or by sterilizing the male flies by irradiation, this will have to be a truly cooperative effort involving a number of countries and international agencies, just as control of the desert locust is already truly cooperative. One other idea, which the advisory committee has considered and which I'd like to mention because of its great potential. It was suggested that a sort of international science corps might be created. It would be composed of distinguished experts in a variety of fields who would devote their efforts to the task of world development. Of course, some may not be too happy at the prospects, fearing perhaps that too much science will dehumanize our world, or that one day we'll all be at the mercy of scientists. Personally, I don't take such fears very seriously. I've met a few scientists in my time, and I've yet to find one who even remotely resembles the power-mad monsters so popular in science fiction. But don't take my word for it. Let me close by quoting a famous biologist, Paul Weiss, of the Rockefeller Institute in New York. He wrote these words: "Let none of us lodge in the master's mansion, but let us all move down into the servants' quarters so that we all may work together, united for human progress in harmonious cooperation. No group can do the job alone. So let us all close ranks, the men of science with those in other walks of life, for humanism and against the dehumanization of our culture."
You have just heard Alexander Scorby in one of a series of special programs from United Nations Radio produced in recognition of 1965. International Cooperation Year.